Good evening and welcome to the November 2017 meeting of the San Luis Obispo Health Commission. First item for this evening's agenda will be approval of the minutes of our last meeting, which was October 16th, 2017. Does anybody have any additions, corrections, comments to make? Hearing none, we'll ask Jean to publish them as she always does, make them available on our website. At this time, we will entertain any public comment from any persons desiring to speak on issues other than any of our scheduled items, but are within the scope of the interest of the Health Commission. Seeing no public comment, we will move right along and begin with our presentation for this evening. We have with us this evening Frank Warren, who's the Division Manager of Prevention and Outreach from our County Behavioral Health Department. Frank, we will turn the mic over to you.
Thank you so much. Microphone? Now I do. What I was saying was I don't think I've spoke to the commission in several years. I think the last time I was here, I may have been talking about the early stages of the Mental Health Services Act's prevention and early intervention plan. So I'll give you a little bit of an update about that as we talk a little bit about what it is that that we do in the division. But I think specifically I was asked to come speak about the prevention of suicide as well as some of the work we're doing around bullying prevention in schools as well. So I don't know if the PowerPoint is visible to all. If I start clicking here, what's going to happen? So this will just kind of help kind of guide through as we talk a little bit about what it is that that we do at the Behavioral Health Department. So as you said, I'm the division manager for the Prevention and Outreach Division, which is a relatively new title to a division that started as the Mental Health Services Act Division. The Behavioral Health Department, as you're all very familiar with, is broken into divisions: Adult Mental Health Services, Youth Mental Health Services, Quality Support, our medical inpatient unit, as well as drug and alcohol services. And so that's where I came from originally, on the prevention side of drug and alcohol services, which now focuses specifically on adult substance use treatment disorders, substance use disorder treatment. And the Prevention and Outreach Division, where I am, we take care of all of the youth and family substance use treatment now, as well as all the prevention work. I also have another hat in which I am the county's Mental Health Services Act coordinator. Every county has a coordinator for the Mental Health Services Act. So on the administrative side of the Mental Health Services Act is the administration team that I manage. But our programs range now from traditional substance use disorder prevention and wellness, programs like Friday Night Live, our preventive health grant programs where we're working in schools primarily with families, young people who are struggling in school and there's a possibility of a substance use issue. We have counselors who work to engage the family and their own resources so that we can help the young person succeed in school. We have now are stewarding the new opioid safety coalition grant. I just returned from San Diego this last week. I was at the opioid policy summit for California, where I was really glad to see that the work done in the previous grant really established a very strong coalition here, and we are right in line with every other good coalition in the state of California. We are doing everything that everyone who is great is doing. So I was really happy to know that there wasn't a whole lot to bring back in terms of, hey, we should be doing this too. We're doing really great work there. So we're very proud to be taking on that new part of the grant. We do a lot of work around suicide prevention, and we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about that. Some of that work has been brought to us because of the work we've done on college campuses in the last few years. The Mental Health Services Act supports a prevention and wellness liaison to both Cal Poly and Cuesta, and that person really is there to bridge the gap between community mental health and wellness activities and the campus communities. As we know, it's a high-risk population, and we've spent a lot more time there. We also have our early intervention programs, which include counseling on school campuses. We have some school campuses, high schools, that contract with our team to have a therapeutic response on campus. We have a middle school program where at 6 of the 12 public middle schools, we have a student assistance program that is funded through the Mental Health Services Act. And then, as I was saying, we also have a grant, a federal grant, to do a program around first episode psychosis. So these are people who are experiencing their first, what's called a psychotic break, or their first episodes in mental health issues. And we have a therapist who actually place in the dorms at Cal Poly. So up in Cal Poly Housing is our partner. And we actually have a therapist who is 40 hours a week available to students in an immediate manner, especially for these very high-risk students. I tend to say young people a lot, but I remember that my frame here is students at Cal Poly, and then we do some support for Cuesta as well. The Mental Health Services Act, as I mentioned before, isn't all youth. Of course, that's what our division tends to focus mostly on youth. But in overseeing the whole of the plan, we do have a few projects that we operate out of our division, including our Veterans Outreach Program, where we have a monthly physical activity which engages veterans and their families, and we embed a therapist in that activity so that veterans, service people, can engage in their first discussion in a lot of ways with a mental health professional, knowing that many won't walk through a clinic door to seek that type of help. It's something we're very proud of. It's done very well. It's in its fifth year now, and we just celebrated Veterans Day with a number of really great activities. So that's one of the programs that operates specifically more for adults out of our shop. And then finally, as I said, we do operate all youth and family substance use treatment comes through our division, even though our therapists are placed in the drug and alcohol services locations in Atascadero and Grover Beach. Our South Street location here in San Luis Obispo is our main clinic. And we do walk-in clinics as well as we do have therapists who do treatment on school campuses. And so we have a partnership with the County Office of Education where we place a therapeutic response, a treatment response right there on campus. So I'm very proud of the work that we do. It's a wide range of topics and issues, as you can see. And so it's kind of never a dull moment. But that's really what I think drives us. We are always looking to be innovative and always try to find a new approach to helping our community when it comes to substance use and mental health issues. So I've been with the county, it'll be 23 years next month, and this is an area we're about to talk about that really has always been somewhat in the background. We never really talked so much about bullying and suicide prevention as we do now. A lot of that is because it's become a little bit more popular to have those discussions, which means that's a good thing. That means we've reduced some stigma around the discussions of bullying and suicide. We have more work to do, and I'm going to kind of walk you through some of the things that we're doing specifically in those areas. And I certainly would be happy to answer questions as you go along or as you wait until I kind of wrap things up. I thought I would share with you a few statistics that we know locally about bullying and harassment on campus. All of this comes from the California Healthy Kids Survey, and I think you're probably familiar. That's the biennial survey that's done for 7th, 9th, and 11th graders throughout San Luis Obispo County. Our county has participated in this survey, which is administered statewide for many years, and so we do have longitudinal data that we look at in terms of how our schools are doing in responding to, behavioral health issues. The survey has changed a little over the years. Sometimes the questions are easy to track. You know, for instance, we can tell you that, in the past 30 days, about 42% of our juniors have used alcohol. We could have told you that same statistic back in 1998, 1997. But some of the others are relatively new, including now we ask questions about how people feel about their school climate. Do they feel safe? Have they ever been harassed or bullied? Some of the numbers that I think stand out when having the discussion, and we'll focus here on seventh graders, right, a middle school age. We know that 42% of our local seventh graders say that they've been made fun of or insulted in the past year. Almost 40% have had rumors or lies spread about them, according to them. This is, of course, self-reported. A third have been made fun of because of the way they look or maybe the way they talk. Almost 30% have had sexual jokes or comments or gestures made to them. 20% of 7th and 11th graders, the same number, have been cyberbullied. And about 11% of that bullying is specific to race, ethnicity, or national origin. So while these numbers, depending on how you look at numbers, you know, whether you think that's an alarming amount or not an alarming amount, it's a reality. It's a reality for our young people today to both feel insecure at times, to be insecure at times. And at the other new reality is that I think we are finding that young people are more apt to tell us about it. And so when we ask the question, in the past year, have you ever felt like you've been made fun of or teased or harassed? I think we have a group of young people now who are growing up in an age where they're being a little bit more honest with us and telling us that it is a reality for them. And so our goal, of course, is to, you know, do a couple things. One is to empower those young people to be proactive and address it at the immediate level to let, you know, others know that that's not okay. And the other is to build our institutions and our systems, our parents, our schools, to have the knowledge of how to support our young people. And so let me give you a little bit of an example of some of the things we do around that. There's a program called No Place for Hate. No Place for Hate was an initiative here in the county up until last year. We partnered with the Anti-Defamation League to produce No Place for Hate materials and programs. We certified all of the middle schools in the county, all the public middle schools, to be No Place for Hate schools, which meant that they had specific education around bullying. They had policy development around what to do with the bullying issue. And most importantly, they had programs and activities that helped young people kind of deal with the emotion of harassment and bullying. Some of those include like the conversation couch. These are the things that our Friday Night Live team does on both middle schools and high schools. If you ever get a chance to see it, they do it out in the middle of a quad, in the middle of lunch. They set up a couch and they have a spinning wheel of questions, and people can just, you know, who haven't necessarily known each other, meet each other, sit down and, you know, have a conversation with someone they may have never met before. It's a really great way of introducing people to engaging in with new people and kind of meeting them on a different level than, you know, what typically may happen on a school playground. Desire to Inspire, Unity Tree, all of these things were part of our No Place for Hate programs. Now, although that initiative is over, these are the programs that we still do, both our middle school campuses as well as some of our high school campuses. And then I was just told, I think our Cal Poly Friday Night Live, we have a Cal Poly chapter of Friday Night Live as well. They do some of this type of, they would call it more mental health stigma reduction than bullying prevention, but these are some of the same tools that they use. National Bullying Prevention Month is October, as well as a number of other things that happen in October. In that month, we have our programs and our dialogue focused on cultural competence, tolerance, acceptance, and making sure that we are creating both physically as well as emotionally safe environments for the young people that we work with. So we do that in our shop through training. We have an August training for all staff that focuses on cultural competence. It focuses on how we use trauma-informed care training to be sure that our staff are taking care of one another, taking care of themselves, so that when they walk onto campuses and maybe they're dealing with a volatile issue like bullying may lead to, or harassment, or even a suicide prevention issue, that they're equipped and prepared to be very supportive to the family or the student or the school that's in need at that moment. Finally, the national awareness really builds on encouraging proactivity, encouraging young people to speak up, talk to their teacher, talk to their parents, talk to their counselors, whomever it might be, and let them know that bullying is happening. They feel it's happening. They see it happening to one of their friends. Of course, the cyberbullying issue is something you probably hear about in the media a lot. These are things that often go unspoken because they're happening, we'll say, teen to teen or tween to tween. Our teachers, our parents, youth advocates need to be more proactive themselves in drawing some of that out so that they can learn what is happening maybe, you know, behind closed doors at night in our social media age. And so that's a lot of the work that gets done around bullying. Of course, there's a number of studies that trace bullying to higher risk emotional behaviors, including suicide attempts or ideations. It's not always a direct, you know, connection between those who have been bullied and those who will feel suicidal, but it is certainly something that our counselors work with our young people around, being sure that they can distinguish what those feelings are. In terms of suicide prevention, we know that based on the California Healthy Kids Survey, about 18% of our local 11th graders report having seriously contemplated suicide in the past year. And just in terms of raw numbers, if you look at the 2015-16 data, which is where that's pulled from, that's 332 of your local 11th graders have expressed that. That's a pretty, if you think about this room being filled with 332 young people, I think that's a pretty alarming statistic. It doesn't say that we are, you know, better or worse because of that number. I think it makes us understand that this is a reality for, you know, nearly a fifth of our young people walking around. And so I think that's something that's important to note. We also know that about a third of those same juniors, if they didn't necessarily feel suicidal, they did feel sad or hopeless for, you know, every day in a two-week period in the last year, so much so the way the questions asked that it stopped them from doing usual activities, whether that was going to school or sports or being involved in other or work, you know, or being involved in other organizations. So these are serious numbers. They're ones that we talk about a lot. Our schools are very, our county schools are very good at collecting this data and responding to the data. They share it with their staffs. They bring us on campus when need be to talk about some of the Healthy Kids survey numbers. Of course, the rest of the survey has a lot to do with alcohol and drug use, violence, school climate, around school, you know, how people feel about going to school, et cetera. And we, of course, focus on mostly the substance use and the mental health issues. But it also talks about eating behaviors and other public health type things as well. Our county numbers are a little bit hard to pinpoint. We have not had an official number, you know, state rate produced in the last 2 years. As of 2014, our county's average was 13.9 per 100,000. These were suicide completions. That is above the California average at that time of 10.5 and the state, the federal average, I'm sorry, of 12.9. Traditionally, we have, in the last 10 years or so, when we've looked at these numbers and when they've been published, we have been in the bottom 20 of the 58 counties in terms of our overall suicide rate.
Pardon me, what was the denominator again on the suicide?
100,000. Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's 13.999, so it's essentially 14 of 100,000. Yeah. And that was the average over 2007 to 2014. For those of you doing statistics at home, yeah, out of 100,000.
One completed.
Yes, I will not be doing math in public. I will appreciate all math in public, but I refuse to do math in public. So, in terms of a suicide prevention rate or a number. When the Mental Health Services Act came to fruition, I think I'll do the quick 101 on the Mental Health Services Act, which I've referred to. This was Proposition 63 in 2004. This established a tax in the state of California for people who make $1 million or more. This tax then produces revenue for all 58 counties based on a specific proportion and population. And the money is designed to overhaul the traditional mental health clinic system. So the first wave of funds came to each county and said, hey, it's time to start doing things differently. It's time to start focusing on your highest end, most severely mentally ill residents. It's time to start wrapping around them with additional rehabilitative supports versus just coming in for medication or treatment. It's designed to address underserved populations. Maybe your county has a specific language barrier, or maybe you don't have enough people who are qualified to serve seniors or the LGBTQ community, whatever that might be. The Mental Health Services Act came to fund that change. Part of that funding included something called prevention and early intervention. And with that, a lot of mental health programs had not done any type of prevention work before. They were, it's a treatment-based field. They reached across the aisle to their drug and alcohol services counterparts, or the drug and alcohol, or alcohol and other drug counterparts like us, and asked for some work around prevention. And one of the only real tenets of the prevention programming through the Mental Health Services Act was to focus on suicide prevention and stigma reduction. And so the suicide prevention rate is this kind of target number that, of course, if you know that if you can, you know, see a reduction in that rate, you hopefully can say that your interventions are working. So we haven't necessarily established a goal or a number at this point in time, but working with our community partners, including Transitions Mental Health Association, Community Counseling Center, Wilshire Community Services, Family Care Network, and on, we have a regular ongoing discussion about suicide prevention and what efforts should be taken in our community. There is a suicide prevention council in our community that has been wonderfully led by a collection of volunteers, and Transitions Mental Health Association, or TEMA, has been leading that for a while. I'll jump to one of the last slides you'll see. One of the great things that I can announce is that the stakeholders for the Mental Health Services Act have funded or have approved funding for a suicide prevention coordinator. So all the things I'm about to talk to you about really will sound a lot better when you invite the new suicide prevention coordinator, whomever that may be, in the near future. But I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things that are happening policy-wise. The first and most significant for us here in our world is Assembly Bill 2246. This is the bill that now basically mandates each school in California address suicide prevention. They have to construct policies on campus beginning this school year. The policy needs to address what's happening for high-risk groups on campus. There should be suicide awareness and prevention training for teachers. That's now a mandate. There's, at this point in time, there is no specificity to that mandate in terms of what or how many hours or what the training has to be. I will tell you this, that our county has jumped on this and have really taken this very seriously. We have been, I think, in contact or done training in each district by this time. And this is for something that just rolled out with very little specificity. But our schools have been very proactive, and I'm very, very proud of that for our county. The mandate does not apply to private schools or elementary schools below grade 7. The policy, these are some of the slides we've used to train some of our schools, just to give you a little bit of a flavor of what it is that they're being asked. The schools are being asked to work with their local mental health community, as well as stakeholders, law enforcement, suicide prevention experts, et cetera. The policy has to address procedures related to suicide prevention, intervention, and something that's very important to us, postvention. Postvention, and I'll give you a little bit more detail here in a minute, is something that we tend to respond to schools, sadly, a great deal in our community. We get asked for counseling and support when a suicide has been completed by a student, and whether that's on the campus, but even if not, in our small communities that make up San Luis Obispo County, the school communities are impacted by suicide a great deal. And it's not always by a student. It could be by a family member of a student or a former student. And all of those things have happened for us in the past year. The staff training that happens on campus goes over risk factors and warning signs, suicide prevention, and most importantly, intervention. So we now have the ability to talk with teachers about how to ask the questions, how to talk with students about thoughts of suicide, so much of this has to do with reducing stigma. You know, you've all heard, and it's, you know, it's we've known for years to not challenge a person who says they're suicidal. Oh, just go ahead and do it because you never will. Those types of, you know, frames. We've grown up and understood that that's not effective, and in fact, it could be very damaging. So we're able to go on campuses where maybe not everyone has learned that message. And so some of this is a reiteration of what you and I may think of now as very common sense approaches to suicide. There's a lot of discussion in the training about traumatic stress and emotional health that our young people carry. And so being able to find and identify signs of suicide is really not much different than looking for signs and symptoms of a substance use issue or another type of behavioral health issue or a mental health issue. You're looking for changes in friends and clothes and appearance, and you're looking for, depressed mood swings, mood changes. That's very difficult when you're a teacher on a campus with 1,000 teenagers. Those are all very similar types of signs. So this training really does have to help teachers be able to feel empowered that sometimes it's okay just to ask the question if they have a gut feeling, because sometimes that can save a life, and we encourage them to ask those questions. Having two post-teens, I guess they are now almost, this is a very different generation. They are very open about their feelings, their emotions. Our young people now are a little bit more okay than they were a few years ago in being asked how they feel. They share that information. The key, as we do in talking to our faculty about this training, is sometimes it's really about who asks them and the power that our faculty, our teaching faculty, have in their admiration from their young people is very important. And that is no different than how we talk with our teaching staff about addressing substance use issues either. Sometimes that's the right person to ask the question. They feel a comfort and a safety. So this is we're very excited about having now a policy reason to go on campus to be able to address more than just, let's say, the health teacher, the PE teacher, et cetera. And then you see there again, one of the other mandates is that there needs to be in their policy a response to what happens after a suicide occurs or postvention. We'll talk about that too. There is some discussion in the training about youth who are at an elevated risk. Those groups may include those young people who've been affected by suicide. Maybe it's been a friend, a loved one, someone in their family, or maybe even somebody they idolized. I think have all kind of had that understanding that young people will emulate others. And so while all of this has to happen for our young people, we as a society have to be, improving how we talk about suicide, in the public and how it is recognized, the role of mental illness, and depression, in suicide, compounding factors of trauma in suicide, and that we kind of stop criminalizing it. One of the things that I learned in a training a few years ago, it was we should stop saying commit suicide. He committed suicide. She committed suicide. We usually reserve that word for illegal behaviors. He committed assault. They committed robbery. And suicide isn't a criminal behavior. It's a traumatic behavior. And so these are some of the things that we should be talking openly about. Our young people are there, but we're bringing our teachers along. And so part of that discussion is being able to understand that there are higher risk populations. Our lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, questioning youth are at a much more elevated risk, partly because of the stigma that comes in their daily life, how those things may be addressed in the environment that they're in, how things may be responded to at home with their peers, et cetera. We have young people who are using substances to mask issues. We have young people who are using substances to medicate issues. All of those young people are at higher risk for suicide or other types of self-harm. So having that discussion with teachers we're finding to be very welcome. I think our teachers understand this population really well. There is also a need to be sure that you have someone there to intervene. So, like I said, we do have counselors on many campuses. Most campuses in San Luis Obispo County have either a permanent therapist. This is a clinical therapist, somebody with a license, either as a social worker or as a therapist, or is an intern to be a therapist, working on campus most of the week. But that's impossible to fund necessarily for every school. And so we need to help schools, and we do spend a lot of time working with our schools and making sure they know how to access those therapists and that therapeutic response. One of those in our county, the Mental Health Services Act funds, is the what we call the Mental Health Evaluation Team, formerly known as Mobile Crisis. So it's a 24/7 response. I will tell you, just anecdotally running into that staff, they are doing more work on school campuses this year than they have in the last few years. Now, that's a bad thing. That's a good thing. Part of the good thing is that means schools are accessing that support, and they're bringing professionals onto campus to deal with some of these, you know, emotional crisis issues, which are, as you can all imagine, critical to address early in the stage of the issue. But there also needs to be a place on campus for young people to feel safe. There need to be trained people on campus for when that therapist isn't available to know what to do and how to help young people build their safety plan, et cetera, if suicide is the issue that they're dealing with. So we do a lot of training with staff about connecting to resources, and that's very critical. There's also what happens when a young person wants to come back to school. So I'll use our Cal Poly example. That's a very significant impact when you have a young person, let's say, who they live in the residence halls, and they have four other roommates. And everyone knows. And now they have to come back to school. They have to pick up where they left off. There needs to be support for that. The school needs to understand that young person, that student, is going to need some extra attention and care. And importantly, those roommates, the environment, the teachers, the classmates are also going to need to be given support and help as well. So all of these, as I kind of draw these, you know, wide pictures, they are starting to weave together. We are seeing more and more schools kind of connecting the dots that they may need help when it comes to this return to school, or maybe, like I was saying earlier, the death was off campus and maybe affected a family member, but that family member was very significant to a large population of students who are now on campus but not feeling connected to, you know, the suicide because it happened by a non-student, you know? So those conversations are happening, and we definitely are seeing an improvement in how schools are preparing for that. Okay, postvention. Postvention is how we deal with the completion of a suicide on a campus to be sure we're caring for that community. As I was saying before, we do get this phone call for counselors for extra added support, and, you know, unfortunately, there's been schools that have chosen to not make that call and felt that they could just handle it themselves and kind of they rally people together. So if that's going to be the case, we want to be sure that people on that campus are trained at least in how to deal with some of this emotional trauma that comes after a suicide, which is different than that which may come after death by a vehicle crash or other causes. And so there is a different way to talk about suicide on campus after the fact, and we want to be sure that schools are going to either A, reach out for help to do that, and if not, be sure that they're trained to be able to do it on their campus as well. What I was very happy to see in the assembly bill was that the state is recognizing that need as well and understanding that reality, that some schools are very much like islands. They're going to deal with things in their culture, and that's okay, but we want to make sure that they're prepared in that culture. And that includes support of siblings and family members and other faculty as well, who, you know, any of you who have worked with young people know, you're emotionally caught up with them for life. And so if these things happen, you may seem detached, but you're going to pay an emotional toll as well. So good discussions are happening on school campuses around that. We outlined for all of our schools the different, programs. This is a slide that's from one of those trainings, so it does outline for school staff how to contact the county mental health direct line, which is the managed care line. We also give them information for Hotline, which of course is our fantastic resource that we have in this county, and everyone should be able to access. But there's also national suicide prevention lines that are phenomenal. They have national suicide text lines as well. A lot of our young people won't pick up the phone call to talk to somebody, but they will text. And so the text lines we make available, and I apologize for not bringing all of these brochures and resources, but these are the things that we bring out when we do these trainings as well. And that over there on the right-hand side is a description of the mental health evaluation team, which again is a 24/7 response. They work a lot with law enforcement in the hospitals, and primarily deal with adults, but they have been doing more and more school visits this year. Some of the trainings, you don't have, it's very small print, but I'll tell you about some of the trainings that we are doing in school campuses right now for our teaching faculty. The first on top there is More Than Sad. More Than Sad is produced by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. If you are familiar with the suicide prevention walk that happened at the beginning of October, that's AFSP. Their curriculum is called More Than Sad. It's very good. Teachers, family members, students respond very well to More Than Sad as a training. We think it's going to be one of the trainings that the state will, when they eventually get around to regulating which trainings you have to have, we believe More Than Sad will be one of those trainings. So we're already doing it on campus, and we have our staff, our entire staff is trained in providing that training. Mental health first aid is very popular. It is not a specific suicide prevention training. It is really much more of a mental health first response type training. So all of us here are first responders when it comes to mental health crises, because it will be our brothers and children and our neighbors who will need our help at some point in time. It could be our clients or our customers as well. But either way, it makes all of us first responders. Mental health first aid takes that same approach as physical health first aid does. And so it's a very good training. It's a longer training than any of these others. QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer, is another certified suicide intervention training. It's a very simple training to be certified in. It does not take, it's only a couple hours. It will walk you through how to engage a person who may be suicidal, how to help them establish their own safety, and then how to be sure that they get the help that they need. We also offer that training countywide. We have trainers at Cal Poly. We have trainers in our department, Transitions Mental Health Association, a number of organizations. So QPR is one of those that we also feel may become eligible for schools. And then finally is ASSIST, Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training. ASSIST is typically trained. It's a longer training. It's very engaging in depth around like small group discussions and how we can improve kind of our social existence, around suicide. It talks about how we talk to each other. It's a very in-depth type of approach. We don't have that training as available. We're trying to get more people trained in doing that so that we have a menu to be able to offer to schools as well. And this past year, our team, and I will say, and our team now also includes our partnership with Transitions Mental Health Association. They've actually brought in a couple grants to be able to do on-campus work around mental health first aid, and then they've been staying on campus to do suicide prevention work as well. All of the six middle schools that are in our Mental Health Services Act, so that's Atascadero Middle School, Flamson Middle School, Judkins, Mesa, and Lucia Mar District, Santa Lucia and Cambria, as well as Los Osos Middle School, and Laguna also had the training this year as well, so seven of the 12. And then we've done district training at San Luis Coastal, Templeton, Lucia Mar, and Coast Unified as well. So we continue to kind of build the training piece of this as we get more and more people certified so that schools have that resource. Some of the other things that I think I may have touched on some of this include our student assistance programs. So when we rolled out the prevention and early intervention component of the Mental Health Services Act, one of our key transitional ages that we were working with was middle school, a very high-risk population for early signs of behavioral health issues, whether that's mental health or substance use behavior. And so we had a competitive process where six middle schools were given a half-time therapist or a half-time counselor, a half-time family advocate who's bilingual, and then a youth development program. In our case, it's what's called Club Live, it's Friday Night Live for middle schools. And those three individuals then work as a team with the school's nurse and counselor and administration and teaching staff. And basically, they triage young people who are showing very early signs of any type of risk. So whether it's a true behavior issue, like a disruption in class, to one where maybe just, a student hasn't spoken in 2 days, and a teacher says, I want to address it. So teachers are now able to get them immediately engaged and talked with and seen, and then hopefully maybe they need counseling, maybe they just need to be introduced to a positive activity, maybe they need a little extra help tutoring, or that family advocate may be able to engage their parents. Their parents may be needing help at that point in time. So that program has been going on since 2009. It's going very well. And that's the student assistance programs. That's an evidence-based practice. We also, as I was saying before, we have over 10 high school campuses that either contract for our services or we are on campus doing treatment level work around substance use issues. And that's just from the prevention and outreach division. Of course, our youth mental health services division is on a number of campuses and working with more severely mentally ill students, either in special education classes or they're working at the county office of ed as well. I think I mentioned that we have a wellness liaison that does activities and engages the campus communities and their mental health clubs and organizations so that we're all working together, community-wide. And then, of course, I mentioned the first episode psychosis program. So we have a therapist who's embedded in the housing region at Cal Poly, which, as you know, has grown a great deal over the last few years. And so those young people are as far away from the health center as you or I may be in our daily life from our doctor's office, as well. And so trying to move that engagement even closer to them has been a real benefit, especially for those young people who are living like mine, way out as far in Poly Canyon as possible. So that's I know a lot of information about a lot of different things, but I thought it would give you a little bit of an overview of what all we do, but more focused on how we're addressing some of the bullying and suicide prevention issues that you asked about. But I'm happy to answer any questions or comments.
Thank you for the information. Thank you spending the time with us this evening. I see David's light on, so let's start to my left and come this way with questions. Okay.
Frank, thank you very much. That was very excellent information that you provided us, and we appreciate that. Do you find that the seventh graders are likely to be honest with the issue of bullying, or do they tend to say things that they think that you want to hear?
So one of the questions we used to get around the Healthy Kids Survey before they asked emotional type questions like that was, there's no way these young people are telling you the truth about their drug and alcohol use. So WestEd, which is the state organization that does the survey, they are stacked with scientists. And they started developing parts of the survey that are basically ways of validating the answers so that your questioning leads young people to be the most honest as possible. There will always be risk of one or two that can get in there and kind of manipulate or negotiate their way around the answers. So one of the things that WestEd does and our County Office of Ed has done is done focus groups when the results are released, and then gone and asked young people if these feel real, if these are different. Those are a little bit more scrutinous because when you have young people in a room, they may not be as honest as they would have been quietly taking an anonymous, survey. So there is always some sort of risk that you're not going to get a complete answer. We feel very confident statewide that the Healthy Kids survey is valid and it's going to get as close as possible.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. Quick question for you. Substance abuse, obviously there's a close link between the substance abuse as well as suicide, especially in this county. Mm-hmm. Now, do we have a sort of inpatient substance abuse program for the children?
No.
Okay. So if they need that, because oftentimes they may be in the household environment where substance abuse is going on,
yes,
and it's not a safe place for them, what are the options? What do we do with them?
Thank you for asking the question. Anytime I get to answer that question so simply and say no, we don't have residential youth substance use facility. It's important for people to understand that. So what happens now is, in terms of county response, is a young person can come in to any of the drug and alcohol services centers in San Luis at our South Street location, receive an assessment. And if they meet Medi-Cal eligibility, they can be treated in either a level that is more of an outpatient, type of treatment, or we now have an intensive outpatient level as well, which is 4 days a week or 9 hours, a week. But that's about all they can do at the outpatient level here. Otherwise, then they would be referred to an inpatient unit or an inpatient treatment facility, which may be as far as Ventura, some Santa Barbara, and then north as well. So we do refer families to those centers when we need to.
So the problem with that is because these children do not have a transportation, mm-hmm, they are really relying on their guardians, mm-hmm, to transport them for these outpatient,
yeah,
sessions. And that's very difficult to, yeah, follow through. So is there a plan for us to have some kind of inpatient facility?
I have never been party to that discussion in terms of anyone bringing us to the table to say we've got a plan for it. Anytime we have an opportunity, vendors will come through telling us about their residential facility, which is typically located in Los Angeles County or somewhere, and we try to give them real estate brochures and, invite them to look around this area. Somebody years ago told me that, those facilities are very market driven, and that obviously somebody is doing that research that's telling them that there's not a reason, to have one here. And I speak for, my colleagues at Drug and Alcohol Services, we felt for years that somebody was missing out on this exact thing that you're describing, which is the difficulty it is to tell a family to pack up and take their young person miles and miles away to get the treatment they need because of the upheaval. And typically young people will get left behind and the parents will say, well, we'll figure out a different way. And I've learned a lot about that on the mental health side because there's a great lack of residential treatment for mental health patients in our county as well for now. So it's something that I invite the discussion. I hope at some point in time we can, look at investing in that type of response. But I've never been part of that conversation to this point.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
I'm wondering about kids that go to private schools. Mm-hmm. Do they get the same services? Do they have the same requirements for the training and all that?
Well, they don't have the same requirement based on this bill. I will say that we do have a pretty good relationship with Mission College Prep. We know a number of people who have, we've had programs on that campus in the past. So we make ourselves available to all schools, regardless of their public-private, standing. And there's been occasion where we've been invited to come on and do trainings. I can't say whether we've been asked to do any suicide-specific training, but we've made it available to all schools that when they're ready, we have people who are trained in More Than Sad, and it's a really great curriculum to come onto a campus with. So I'm hopeful. And if any private schools out there here, they can certainly call. I put Kim Mott's number on this, who is the program supervisor over this part of our division. But anyone can contact me, and we'll go do that training.
Yeah, that'd be great. I have grandchildren who don't live in the county, but they go to Catholic school.
Yeah.
I was in there in that age group.
Yes.
I'm listening to this thinking, wow, something.
Yeah.
And I also want to compliment you on the Veterans Outreach.
Thank you.
It's a great program.
Yeah, I'm married to
a veteran, and we've done many activities with them. It's just fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
I have a question, but just a comment to Gina's question about inpatient treatment. Mm-hmm. Isn't the proposed new facility for the Templeton area, if it ever comes to be, isn't that supposed to have some adolescent beds?
Whether it will be specific to substance use is what I'm not sure of.
I believe
there is going to be youth beds in that facility. I don't know who the provider is at this point in time and whether they'll be offering drug treatment at that same venture, and I don't recall the conversations being specific to drug treatment.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Ferry.
Hi.
Couple of questions. On the treatment on school campuses, how is it that you're measuring the impact and the success of that? I know that you've had it for a while, but I've always been curious about that.
This is a great question, and the reason I didn't get to shave today, because I was back working on this exact conversation, and I thought I would have enough time to go home and get cleaned up before you all, but I didn't.
I can't see that you haven't shaved. So
we focus on... So in the Healthy Kids survey, for instance, they asked the question, over the last 30 days, how many times have you used substance A, B, C, whatever it might be?
Yeah.
That is, as I was saying, that we've been tracking that for a long time. The scientists believe that the 30-day mark is your most active user, right? So if you can use that 30-day mark, you'll know whether you're going to see progress. So if you make a change in that 30-day mark. So in all of our counseling programs, we ask the question in a retrospective pre-post. So for instance, it used to be we would do a pre and then a post. So you came in to meet me and Chris comes in and I say, okay, Chris, fill this out. And it says, how many times have you smoked marijuana in the last 30 days? You don't know me. And so it's most likely that you're going to put none.
Right.
Well, now we're going to spend 8 to 10 weeks together and you're going to get to know me and you're going to trust me. And then I'm going to say, okay, answer that question again. And you're going to say, well, two, right? Well, that's going to look like an increase. Well, it's because when you first came in, you probably were smoking 5 to 6 times a week, and you didn't want to tell me that, right?
Right.
So now we do what's called a retrospective pre-post. So every young person gets asked the question, before you met me, when you first started working with me, about how many times were you smoking marijuana? And then they'll tell you. And then about how many times now? So we find that to be a far more realistic. So we use those types of measures. We ask alcohol, marijuana, prescription drugs, and then an other drugs group, which includes cocaine, methamphetamine, things like that. So we're looking to make a change or an intervention that changes the 30-day use. So that's one of the indicators. Another we've introduced is suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. How many times in the last X amount of, I think it's 2 weeks in our survey, did you seriously contemplate suicide? So the questions mirror what's in the Healthy Kids survey,
right.
But these are for kids who are in our treatment or counseling services. So the big three, which we call when we report back to schools, are change in symptomology or behavior, right? Academics. So did your grades improve after being more consistent here? And to be honest, that one doesn't always change a great deal. There are some times where we have to send a young person to a residential facility, which is a good thing for them, but
right,
bad for
drop.
The grades. Yeah.
Right.
And then the other is disciplinary referrals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's really important that once you start working with us, that you kind of drop off the vice principal's radar, right? We're looking to kind of get you out of trouble and get you a little bit more consistent. So those are the three big factors that we track. And then we report, and what I was joking about was we report to the county the reduction in substance use. So was there an impact and suicidal ideation? And then there's a general question we answer, which is did the risk factors decrease? And so it's an aggregate of several different questions we ask, whether or not they're hanging out with, other people. Are they trying to do more positive things? You know, so it's, we those are the questions we answer.
Thank you. That was really helpful. One of the things that you mentioned was the suicide rate too, and what you're not able to track is the overdoses that may be suicides but haven't left a note or haven't expressed to someone, right? So that rate actually could be higher.
Very true.
Yeah,
I'm learning a great deal as I'm being exposed more to opioid prevention. Mm-hmm. And policy in the amount of work that Dr. Bornstein's team has done in training the coroner in how to recognize an opioid-related death. But, you know, it's very tricky. We haven't done that so well with suicide. The other area where we're trying to make a statewide improvement is in media coverage and how the media cover suicide deaths. You know, you have many newspapers which have policy which says not to print a suicide in there, and whether or not that's the right thing to do or not, how they talk about it, report it. So death reporting is very, very tricky, and so I would agree with you that it's likely underreported around suicide. Mm-hmm. And also you have suicides which are accidental, but the term is suicide. So, you know, whether the suicide was, you know, what we paint in our heads, you know, or was it, you know, purely accidental?
Yeah,
it's very difficult.
Yeah, I have a question about bullying, and then I'll pass it off. One of the things that I heard today was they just had a survey that they were looking at a national incidence of hate crimes, and they've seen that over the last year they've gone up about 5% nationally, which is pretty astounding. 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but it certainly is.
Yeah.
Have you found anything that correlates with that in terms of the increase in bullying or being affiliated to someone's religion or being more hate crime oriented locally with the kids? Or
I showed you the one stat which came from the 15-16 school year, which said 11% of those seventh graders who were bullied felt it was because of their race, race, ethnicity,
or sexual preference. Yeah,
that's not in that one stat, but that number two. Mm-hmm. I think all of us are going to be pretty interested to see what it looks like when the 17-18, you know, results are released. I will say that in terms of correlation, obviously, I don't know that the national emotion is related to having an increase in crisis calls to schools, but we have seen an increase in crisis calls to schools. And sometimes that's, you know, I did DUI prevention for years. I ran the DUI program. And at the same time I was running the DUI prevention side of the house, I was running the DUI classes side of the house. And it's a real fine line between going out and telling people, hey, don't drink and drive. And so you want to reduce the amount of drinking drivers. But then one of the tools you use is you increase patrols and saturation to arrest more DUI drivers. So if you have more arrests, did you reduce the amount of DUIs? It's very tricky to manage that, you know, that number in prevention. And I think the same goes for a lot of issues around stigma and mental health, where it's a good thing that more people are seeking counseling.
Yes.
But if you look at the numbers, it looks like more people are seeking counseling. And so depending on how you look at that outcome, you're going to make a decision. So is more calls about crisis from a school campus a good sign or a bad sign? I think is a really good conversation for us to have, because I could honestly say it's a good thing on some days.
Yeah. I lied, you guys. I have one more question. You mentioned the crisis, and when you were talking about the mobile crisis unit responding more to schools, how many people can actually respond at a time during the day with the mobile crisis unit?
Yeah, so the contract that we have with Sierra Wellness requires two on call at all times.
Okay.
So they have they have an expanding capacity
that's
they've had
to use.
That's for the county. Okay. Yeah. And for the most part, and I've just done all their stats, you know, as well. For the most part, that company has really met that need. They they find themselves in Shandon getting a phone call for Napomo, mm-hmm. and they have worked very hard to make it work. It's a very difficult thing to do. We've tried to relax some of the San Luis Obispo use, where we have a person on the behavioral health team who works specifically with the emergency departments in San Luis Obispo, so that the MET team or the mental health evaluation team doesn't have to cover those. But I'm pretty astounded when I look at how much ground they cover in a short amount of time. And it does, you know, kind of go up and down. We had some Cal Poly statistics student this summer did a ton of research for us on the response. So if we could see if we could find any trends, like what day of the year gets the... Mm-hmm. And, you know, we haven't had enough data to really make those kinds of determinations. But I will say they're working very hard to cover a lot of ground.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm done. I promise.
Thank you for the presentation today. Really, thank you. A couple of questions that came up. One was, does the county have any sort of like a multidisciplinary team around suicide prevention and bullying in terms of, I mean, understanding that for many of these young people, that there are multiple traumas that are often occurring or things that are happening at home where they may not be well supported. Do people get together in terms of people who are working in the domestic violence field in the community, teachers, substance abuse people, where they're all sort of coming together at the table specifically focused around sort of this piece of suicide prevention and also bullying, where everybody sort of brings their perspectives and can share and triage.
I wish I could say there was something more specific. There are multidisciplinary teams that are exactly how you portray them, but typically they are drawing together based on a behavior issue that is spawned by trauma. And so the discussion is probably more centered around trauma, which may also include history of suicide or mm-hmm. exposure to bullying or suicide. And so that team does exist, but at this point in time, I'm not aware of a suicide specific type group that would include your domestic violence, you know, partners and teams, hospice, you know, things like that. I think that is something that I'm guessing has naturally just kind of formed based on an incident, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't be able to pick up a phone call and pull that team together right now. Mm-hmm. I know the partners are out there,
yeah.
and believe me, in this county, they would all be at the table. Like, that's one thing you can honestly say about this county, that all of those organizations pull together, you know, when the time, you know, comes. So it's not difficult, but I don't know of it existing.
Thank you.
What's the status of the Templeton facility at this point?
I have no idea. I'm not involved. I'd love to know. I came here to ask you.
The Templeton inpatient psychiatric facility.
They disappeared off the radar.
Really?
Have you heard?
I asked that question to Frank's boss recently, who interestingly also didn't really know. Other than to say that there's still a plan in place.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you more. We need residential facilities for our community in a lot of different ways. So I think our department has been very supportive of just the general move in that direction. And, you know, I'm hopeful that maybe in a few years the discussion opens up at the county level about those kind of types of gaps. So, yeah, we're ready to come to the table, that's for sure.
Thank you so much for such a comprehensive presentation. So I have a selfish question. So I'm the mom of a middle schooler, so I really appreciate all of the work that you're doing with the middle schools and in the high schools as well as my kids move through those.
Yeah.
But I also teach at Cal Poly. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that over the last decade of teaching I have noticed is that the training around mental health issues and suicide prevention is really spotty for faculty and staff. So, and it's we're all very busy, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I think we also all really care about our students. So I guess selfishly, the question is, who can we contact to get training started? And do you do trainings for whole departments? Because often it's kind of nice to have a bunch of faculty together or faculty and staff together in the same place getting trained.
Yeah. So I'll say this about Cal Poly, and I think that I'll be revealing any great mysteries here, but Cal Poly is also built on a system of islands.
Yeah.
And so I'm very fortunate, being the county guy who gets to come in from the outside and say, like, have you talked to this person over here? Because you're doing the exact same thing, and you may not know it, because right. you're all very, very busy. So one of the great resources you have on your campus is Dr. Hannah Roberts in the Health Center. Right. She's a QPR trainer. They do have a series of trainings that they make available for both QPR, and I believe Mental Health First Aid is operating out of the Health Center now. We go on campus and help with Mental Health First Aid. For instance, this past year, we've been really trying to encourage housing to get all of their resident advisors trained, as well as the orientation leaders.
Great.
A great number of WOW leaders and orientation leaders have been trained, but for faculty, I believe the Health Center is the one who was coordinating that. But as you also know, you have a psychology department mm-hmm. on campus who does a lot of things also that sometimes I can't even keep track of as well, because it's not always in concert with the other on campus. So I would also refer you to the on-campus psychology department. They've been training students to be trainers of different curriculum as well. We, of course, will respond and help connect those dots or come on campus when possible. But I really appreciate that thought of training an entire department. So much of training and why it's working with our school campuses right now is if you send one, I keep picking on health teachers, if you send the health teacher off to, you know, a training, even if it's just up to Rancho El Toro to the County Office of Ed, and expect that health teacher to come back then and share everything that you've learned, that's really not effective. But if you train a department together, they learn the language together, mm-hmm. they're going to be supportive of one another. That's a great investment for a department to make for the students. Mm-hmm. But as you know, being on the campus, not just as a parent of middle schoolers, but you're seeing, you know, soon your middle schoolers are going to have to fill out those applications. And the stress that we put our youth through now for college applications, there's a great reason why we see a lot of that exhibited in true crisis and psychological crisis mm-hmm. when they get to campus.
Mm-hmm.
We also send way too many young people to school who aren't prepared to be away at school. Whole nother topic, whole nother day, bring me back. But I would help you anytime.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Actually, I thought of one question as everyone was talking. I work with the seniors in our community, 65 mm-hmm. and older, Medicare. Mm-hmm. What kind of programs do you have in place for this population? Because when I work at a hospital, there's health changes, and these people become very depressed and sometimes suicidal.
I am so embarrassed that I didn't include some of the work we do with seniors. And most of it is that I get to work with is through the Mental Health Services Act. We, in 2009... doubled the capacity of caring callers and senior peer counselors. And so the Mental Health Services Act actually gives Wilshire Community Services a lot of support in depression screening. They do a ton of depression screening, and it's connected now to counseling. So anytime there's a depression screening that they have for an older adult, they can immediately engage them in counseling. Now, of course, all counseling for everybody is, you know, voluntary. And so moving our seniors into wanting that type of extra support and help is the toughest work. And that's what the caring callers and the senior peer counselors have really been engaged in, is trying to move some of our older adults who are not seeking that type of treatment or counseling. We have a program with Wilshire Community Services also has the contract with the county for what's called a full service partnership. So the most severely mentally ill frequent users of the system who are willing to engage in kind of a wraparound treatment, Wilshire takes care of our older adult team. They also do a program that's funded through our Mental Health Services Act innovation component, which allows you to test new ideas and methods. Like our Veterans Outreach was an innovation test years ago. Wilshire is developing right now a curriculum for widows and widowers in building resilience and strength using, they're testing a domestic violence curriculum with older adults. What they're finding, of course, is that a number of widows and widowers obviously are high on the depression scale and are also not necessarily willing to accept treatment, but they are accepting education. And so Wilshire is going about it in a little bit of a different way. We work a lot with them. I think they, and Community Counseling Center as well, are great resources for folks who are looking to help an older adult in our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again for coming.
Thank
you so
much. I
know you said it had been a number of years since you'd been here. You should probably not stay away so long the next time.
Okay.
We're always eager to hear any kind of updates or whatever, so please come back soon.
I appreciate it. Thanks. Okay.
Thanks. Thank you. Don't bother to shave for the rest of the day, Frank. Okay. Yes. All right. Thank you. Dr. Bornstein, we will have the health agency report, if you will.
Sure. I also want to thank Frank. He doesn't hear me on the way out the door, but it seems to me that this is one of those talks that I always have to follow, that I feel that what I have to offer is, just a little bit of this and that compared to something that's a really very big and very overarching and very important topic in our community. So I also wanted to thank him that we keep these kinds of things on the radar screen as I talk about birds and bats and whatnot. But with that, I will give you from the public health department's report, and I will jump right into, you may have seen that we have had an increased number of rabid bats in our county this year in a short period of time, and so that certainly gets our attention. The regular information that we put out about, not handling bats when they're sick bats, call someone to pick it up, like animal services, that information hasn't changed because we went from maybe one a year to three a year. People don't need to be finding bats and killing them or to test them or whatnot, but it is something to be used as a reminder to individuals about how to stay safe. And the other finding that has been creeping up on us just in the last week has to do with dead birds, of which we now have identified five in our county that have tested positive with the West Nile virus, which is a higher number than, I shouldn't say this without knowing for certain, than we've ever seen, but it's certainly in a short space of time a very high number, and we had our first one in San Luis Obispo City. So we're going to be putting out information on that to the public as well as reminders. We're sort of on the end of the mosquito season, but ways in which folks need to protect themselves from these vector-borne diseases. Just to remind folks that Affordable Care Act covered California enrollment. Open enrollment is in place right now. It runs through January, but please don't delay, because if you want to have data, annual coverage to start January 1st, that needs to be done by mid-December, December 15th. And importantly, one of the two major providers under the Covered California program has dropped out, that being Blue Cross. So what's left to our residents is Blue Shield. A very exciting development that should be happening in the next week or so is a launch of a countywide data dashboard of probably close to 200 health indicators. We've been planning for this for some time, and it's coming on the cusp of us readying for our first comprehensive countywide health improvement plan. And so when this comes out, you will all see it soon and be asked to engage with us in that community health improvement process based on the data that is available, so that we would be developing our metrics and our priority issue areas on looking at years' worth of health indicator information. And the nice thing is it'll be a common platform that anyone in the public can go to for updates. Now, I always hear, we've been previewing it, yeah, the data's old. That's just the nature of the beast. Yeah, there's an epidemiologist in our midst of sorts who understands. It's hard to explain why sometimes annual data takes 2 years to post, but it just does. But at least you can look at trend data. And speaking of trends, I may have mentioned this a couple of meetings back, but we really are starting to see even more of it. Is the increased use of medical exemptions for immunizations. Now that personal belief exemption is not an available tool for those whose families do not want to immunize their children, we believe there is a direct correlation between the sudden increase in the number and rate of school students who have medical reasons for not getting their immunizations. I had the opportunity to be with health officers last month at our semi-annual meeting where one of the senators who's been a big advocate for, and in fact was the leading author of Senate Bill 277 that led to the removal of the personal belief exemption. He is a pediatrician by training, Senator Pan, and is very interested in getting our arms around this issue and possibly bringing forth additional legislation to really make sure that we're using medical exemptions as they should be. So stay tuned on that. And lastly, I know some of you on the dais were present for part or most of the day of an air pollution control board hearing that occurred today. I was party to that as a requested witness for the APCD, which is Air Pollution Control District, who has asked for a hearing for their hearing board to convene and look at the issue of requiring abatement by state parks for lack of successful efforts up till this point, and some really effective direction that the APCD is looking for in that regard. It was expected to be a half a day. It is now going to be reconvened for at least one more day. So I will let the commissioners who may have other to say on that do so as it comes to you. But it will be interesting to see what comes of that. And that's my report. Thanks. Bob.
What should you do if you find an ill-looking bat in your driveway on Sunday morning?
Yeah, so certainly bats are nocturnal. So if you see a bat out and about trying to fly and flailing around and, you know, being disoriented or what have you during the day, that is an unusual occurrence and you should call animal control or really at any time. You don't need to necessarily call them out in the middle of the night. I'm trying to spare my brethren. I think there is coverage at all times, but certainly any unusual behavior by a bat, which should be flying about happily during the night and hanging upside down during the day, if that is not occurring, then, you know, I know that Pacific Wildlife Care also will handle those animals and deliver them to animal services if they're not readily available. But it's probably not, the average person should not be handling an ill bat because that might be the moment in time when you get bitten, which is the source of rabies.
Yeah, the essence of my call was, who do you notify? And second question is there any value in reporting a dead bat that you find in your driveway or your neighbors?
So if you can tell if it's recently dead, and it's an unusual finding to be in your driveway, then, so the, I keep referring to Animal Services as the place to pick up the bat, to make the report. But it's our public health laboratory that does the testing for bats, and so they will deliver to us. But the reason I ask about, you know, it, if it's a fresh death, to the extent that you can tell that, not desiccated, not dried out, not, you know, one with the pavement, then we can go ahead and test for rabies.
Sure. So last summer, I found this dead bat, recently dead, it appeared, in my neighbor's driveway. Thank goodness it wasn't mine.
And it's still in your freezer? Because we have heard that kind of thing.
No, it didn't look very meaty, so I didn't see the point in it. And I'm trying to recall the series of calls I made to find out the answer to the question I just asked you. Who do you call? Who's interested? After, I don't know, several calls, very frustrating, I put it in a Ziploc bag without handling it appropriately and threw it in the gully.
Yeah, so
I never got a
dead bat is not going to harm anyone.
No, I quite understood.
If it's days.
But, you know,
later.
Penny, my point is I couldn't find out what the hell to do with it.
So, sadly, I don't have a phone number. I'm sure it's on the county's website. If you just Google Animal Services, there would be a phone number that you can call and say, I have a recently discovered dead bat in my, you know, suburban area that... you know, it's not a normal finding, and we'd like to get it tested. Can you please come pick it up? If you don't get action there because there's only so many animal control officers, and if they're, you know, getting a mountain lion off a ledge or what have you, is I know that Pacific Wildlife Care will also assist. And if you can always call the public health department as well, 781-5500, and we can go that way to try to get Animal Services to assist and give some time frame that they may be able to get to that. Sure.
So that begs the question about the dead birds. I mean, there are dead birds multiple places. How does one identify a bird that needs to be tested?
That is a very good question. How, you know, of all the dead birds, if we were to take them all in and test them, is that the right thing to do? You know, sounds like, I don't know where you all live, but I don't have a good answer. I don't know if the number of dead birds that are out and about in residential communities are so exceptional that we, the public health lab, wouldn't be able to manage it. But our recommendation is traditionally, unless you can tell, you know, sometimes it'll hit your living room window and you know what the cause of death was, but, you know, or see it drop out of a tree, you know, because it was trying to get for that apple or what have you. But if unknown cause of death, an unusual bird or, you know, and again, looking relatively recent, we would definitely recommend that you pursue testing. Same routes, again, probably calling through to public health at 781-5500 to help move that along would be your, one productive avenue.
Good. Does that do it for questions? Tamar.
I don't mean to prolong the questioning. But going back to the increase in the medical exemptions for vaccines, you were referring to within our county, right? And if so, would that mean a medical, would a medical exemption need to be provided by a physician? And would that be a practicing physician in our county? Or, you know, in terms of...
Yes, and yes. And at the moment, and we've tried to dialogue with physicians who have been issuing medical exemptions without a lot of information and try to tease out what the underlying cause of the necessity of a medical exemption is. We will continue to sort of work on that at the same time that other counties are experiencing this quite a bit and in some cases quite a bit more than us. So there, we may be collectively looking toward a legislative way to address that issue.
I have a question about that, too. Is the experience with that what we were seeing with the experience of those people that were coming up with medical exemptions before, which was higher educated communities?
The numbers are still relatively low, so I don't know that I have a sense of, you know, the way we've seen exemptions in the past, particularly personal belief exemptions and which schools in our county and across the state, you can see school by school in a state database what those rates are. We definitely saw more use of personal belief exemptions in private schools. And so that begs the question, likely in higher income families. With respect to the medical exemptions, where unlike personal belief exemptions, where, you know, we would see between 5 and we were getting up toward 10%, I think, one year, the medical exemptions have gone from less than 1% to 1.5% in that, you know, so it's still a relatively small number, but I think public health officials really want to get ahead of it so that we don't start seeing 2, 5, 7%. But so with respect to the medical exemptions in this county that we're seeing, I couldn't really give you any demographics.
Any updates on my favorite subject, influenza?
It's here. We have seen a number of hospitalized cases of, you know, including some younger individuals. I don't know that we, A, seems to be the predominant case, H3, I think, but I'm not sure. Okay, I've got my my sergeant in arms here who said, yes, the H3 strain tends to be a more severe infection than even the H1N1. So, it's not too late to get vaccinated. Thank you for that plug. We have plenty of vaccine. You can get vaccine anywhere. We have definitely seen and heard some really bad cases in younger people who, spend days in the hospital. So that is not worth being opposed to getting a vaccination because I usually get sick from it, or I don't get the flu, or I don't like the needles, or whatever the reasons are. It is a killed vaccine. You cannot get the flu from it. It is, you know, very safe and effective, and especially in younger people. Effective. So you, and even if you do get sick with the flu later on, it's a much less severe version by virtue of having been vaccinated.
Thank you for that and for the questions. So let's move on to our commissioner reports. K. Candace, let's start at your end of the glass.
I have no updates.
Okay. Well, Bob, we know you have something to report.
Well, I wish I had more specifics to report. I've actually spent the entire day in this room starting at 9 a.m. As Penny mentioned, the APCD hearing board heard the complaint from the air pollution control officer against state parks looking for some specific sanctions. As always, it was vastly more complex than I ever guessed. And they're really not asking for enforcement on Rule 1001. It's on some other state nuisance type rules. I was planning to just talk for 5 minutes as your representative. About what we've learned as we've gone through this over the last year and a half or so, but they never got to public comment. We have at least another full day, and public comments will be welcome then. At least that'll give me time to organize some slides a little better. I was kind of relieved. And I wanted to say, Penny talked about the medical aspects of air pollution and how it injures people. It was a great talk. And then she added some personal things at the end that I thought were very effective. Just talking about, help me if I'm misstating this or overstating it, Penny, but talking about basically, here I am again after 8 years, and we're in the same darn place we were when we started this. And I don't know, I thought that was pretty impactful, Penny. They're also relatively...
I uncharacteristically let my heart speak a little bit on this issue and just genuinely said, we all collectively, we being APCD board members, public health, our board, et cetera, have said, yes, we will move with some haste toward mitigating the situation. And I said, I think it's probably hard to look an Nipomo asthmatic in the eyes and say that this constitutes haste. But
so... you will stay tuned and keep us informed. And the next hearing was, the hearing number two, or day two of the hearing, is scheduled for when?
The last Wednesday in November.
That would be November 29th?
Tentatively, yes.
Oh, okay.
They still have to corral state parks witnesses and make sure they can travel on those days.
Okay.
But tentatively, most likely.
Well, thank you for taking that on and representing us. We hadn't heard from anybody for quite some time, and we were wondering about that. So thank you again. Tamar?
No updates.
Chris?
The Adult Services Policy Council submitted a letter from its subcommittee that was looking at the need for an increase in care management, especially for seniors in the community, for those that fall into the gap of having too much income to qualify for Medicaid or for government assistance for care management services, and those that don't qualify for programs like home health, hospice, because they fall medically into a gap where those services are not available, for something like case management or social workers' assistance for assessment and referrals. And those people that earn just little enough that they can't afford to pay out of pocket for those on the private sector. There is some care management pilot programs that are starting now for those individuals, especially for caregivers of long-term care patients who are long-term chronic disease patients or patients that are nearing the end of life where the caregiver is just trying to manage too much with no resources. And the Adult Services Policy Council is going to be providing a letter to the Board of Supervisors, just advising that that really is a need in this community. It's an area of significant gap, and something that we as a community need to begin to look at, because it is not something that is addressed unless it is disease-specific. For those people that aren't associated with a particular program, there really are no resources for them. And we have a growing population that are falling into that gap on a daily basis. And their care is getting incredibly critical as a result of that. The second thing is that in October, Senate Bill 294 was passed and signed by the governor. And that particular bill, and I'm not sure what the impact is going to be, is we're going to stay tuned on that. But that is a bill that expands the services that can be provided by medical hospices to include some palliative care services for patients that are still receiving some curative care. And that is going to be piloted through 2022. It's going to be looked at in terms of what the impact is, and how that's going to roll out and how that's going to be incorporated locally is still being looked at. That's it.
No report.
I just wanted to mention that Thursday we're going to be participating, the county and all of the hospitals, in the statewide medical and health exercise, i.e. the disaster drill. So more to come on that.
I just want to expand to what Dr. Borenstein mentioned about the Cover California. Enrollment period ends at January 31st, but like she said, middle of December 15th, you have to enroll by then and pick a plan for January 1st coverage. But I just want to expand that if people who have under special life event, you lost your job, you lost your health care insurance, you married, adopted children, or had children, many different special qualified life circumstances, you can apply for Cover California any time during the year within the 60 days of that special life event happen. So, but if you do, so that 60-day period is very important. Another thing is that also if you qualify under SenCal, which is Medi-Cal for this area, that also does not have a deadline. You can apply for it throughout the entire year. So that, of course, it's based on income. You have to be below 138% of federal poverty line for individuals, for adult, or 150%, up to 150% below federal poverty line for children. So, and then disabled, blind, and those foster children, if you are in a foster care program, and up to 26, you are qualified to be covered under SenCal. And that program, you can apply anytime. One more thing is that I think a lot of people are not aware of, and I think this affects this community particularly because we have a huge population of a student, right, with student visa and whatnot. If you come here in the United States with a student visa, you are actually, so is a work visa. You're legally here under student visa. You are qualified to apply for Cover California as well.
No report.
Okay, thank you. I have just one short report. Healthy Communities, at our last meeting, we did take a look at the county data dashboard that Dr. Borenstein was talking about. It is impressive. It's fairly easy to, even I could figure out what was going on in that. So I think we all looking forward to having that in place, and I know Claire has spent a lot of time getting that together. And, of course, there were always those questions about how old is it? But that's something we deal with all the time. And it's still good data what is there. And we talked in health communities how we plan to use some of that data as we address some of the built environment situations and some of the reviews that we've done. And we've done actually more than 90 right now. So some of the, not only the county, but some of the our area communities are sending us plans to look at it as well. The HEAL SLOW meeting, I believe, has been postponed or canceled for the next one, which was December, and we'll stay tuned with what's going on with that group. So with that, any of the standing committees, budget, legislative, how about nominating?
Well, we still have at least one opening. We are still looking for candidates. I spoke with Jean before the meeting, and we're talking about maybe doing a Facebook posting and trying to get it out on some social media to draw some attention to it, something that will come across that we can all share and, you know, try to get the word out.
So we're looking for direct provider?
Direct provider.
Okay, so please make the announcement at your groups and what
I have been talking to everyone I know.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah. Including former commissioners.
Oh, good. Okay. All right. Our next meeting, which is December the 11th, will be another planning meeting for all of us. So please come with your ideas for upcoming meetings, anything else that you would like to talk about. We will be meeting in the conference room at Public Health, right, instead of here. So make sure we have that on our calendar. And if no one has anything else, I think we will be adjourned for this evening. Thank you all.